Mick Cochran, a lot of kids want to know about their parents, but not many of them get a gun to go and kidnap their father.
That's right. Well, this character's in a sort of a special case and an extreme case, and I think he probably has some of those same desires and curiosities, but at a specially heightened level. He has no contact with his father until he discovers that he's living in the same city as Fitz, and he pieces things together. He imagines himself as a kind of a private eye, and it's a quest for knowledge, and it's a quest for connection.
You make it sound as if it's something out of Idylls of the King or something like that.
Well, it's maybe archetypal, that desire to find out who his father is and who he is. And there's a story there, but there's a kind of a hunger. And what I tell my writing students is that desire is the engine that drives fiction, and there's a strong desire here that is the sort of the ignition point for this book.
This is your second young adult book after The Girl Who Threw Butterflies. Why young adult?
I was invited to think about writing for young readers. My agent said that someone who works in publishing read my book Sport and said this guy could write for young readers. And I'd never really thought about it before. And I guess I've come to think that I can. Apparently I can. And it a couple of requirements. One, you just have to know what it feels like to be young. And we were all young, and some of us can remember that feeling. And I think to be able to tell a clear story in plain language, not to simplify or sentimentalize. And I think that's the requirements to write for young readers. And a good novel is a good novel, whether it's written for an adult or whether it's written for a young person, I think.
Fitz is 15. When you were 15, we didn't have cell phones, iPads, all of the electronic detritus that circles young adults. You see them walking down the street, every one of them on a cell phone. Is that hard to get past?
It's different, but at the core, we all listen to music, for example. Music is a big part of this book, and the way that music expresses who you are. And maybe we were listening to vinyl, but we still... connected with songs that expressed our longings, and we still had a desire to be creative in some way. So, sure, the technology is different, but the human heart is still the same, and to be young is to be a certain way in the world. So I think, sure, if you're going to write for young people, you have to get the details right, and you have to know how they speak, and you have to know sort of, as you describe it, sort of the mechanics of everyday life. But there are some universals, I think.
Does this become affected by the fact that you're dealing with college students who are a psychological tribe of their own?
Well, it helps to be around young people and to hear how they speak. And I have, two boys, both were teenagers when I was writing the book. And to understand how they express themselves, I think to write this book, I had to get the language right. And there's a kind of a teenage boy way of expressing oneself that's it's got a certain edge, but there's a kind of vulnerability underneath it. And when I could get that language, the way Fitz and his friend Caleb speak, I knew I had it. And I think to be immersed in that language, the language of young people, teenagers, was pretty important.
But the big thing is the gun. Did you have your kids or students of yours read this?
Let me see. Mary read it, my supportive wife, and my agent and my editor, but no kids read it. No teenagers read it while it was in progress.
There's an impression that a gun is a solution to problems. And this weekend, as we record this, we're seeing this in Connecticut. Did anybody raise any questions about that? The idea of this 15-year-old kid spending the $200 to buy a gun because that's the only way he can meet his biological father.
Well, it's a terribly misguided idea, isn't it? But it's a common enough one. So people in fiction do sort of misguided things. And for him, it's sort of ill-formed, this notion that I need someone to pay attention to me. How will I get someone to pay attention to me? And it's sad that there's no other way that he can imagine that coming about. So it's an exploration, I guess, of this sort of misguided notion that it's about power, it's about force, it's about violence. And we see that teenagers today live in cultures of video games. And one of the things Fitz understands, he thinks to himself, puny boys play video games to feel powerful. And so he understands the psychology of it. And he discovers for himself that's not going to work. The alienation and the isolation that he suffers is not going to be solved with force. And the early parts of the book are about a gun. The second parts of the book are more about music. It's about a guitar, about harmony, about making music, about collaboration and expression. So it's a kind of exploration of the inadequacy of violence and force and the necessity of love and connection.
Because he's a pretty average kid. There's nothing unusual about him. The idea of a kid without a father these days is, you know, pretty common because there are so many of them.
That's right. And because they're common doesn't mean that their suffering is any less severe. And so that the way that I think I describe it as a kind of gnawing hunger, it's a constant. Fitz thinks of it as a hole in the middle of himself. So again, it's perhaps a sad commentary that it's both common, but that in no way diminishes the seriousness, the incompleteness, the lack of wholeness that he feels. And I'm afraid that is fairly common in our society, fatherless or insufficiently fathered boys.
His mother is almost enveloping in the way she tries to pretend this biological father never existed, in the way she cuts him off. You know, just this cloak she puts completely around him.
That's right. She's a very good mother, she's had the idea that somehow it just would be simpler, that if the father were gone and he's willing to accept that. And it's sort of a myth. And she wants to believe that she's both father and mother to this boy and giving him everything that he absolutely needs. And she's wrong about that. So she's a wonderful mother, but she's only one person. And Fitz, later, when he does connect with his father, he imagines trying to tell his mother, just because I need a father doesn't mean that you're less of a mother to me.
You set this book in Minnesota, where you went to graduate school. You have lived here a considerable period of time. Why St. Paul, not Buffalo?
There's lots of reasons. Joyce still wrote about Dublin after he was left. And so the St. Paul of my imagination, I not only went to school there, I grew up there. So those streets and those places and the Como Zoo and the particular diner that they go to, those are still vivid and resonant for me. There's a little sort of layering there with the connection to F. Scott Fitzgerald, who grew up in St. Paul, as well as spending time in Buffalo, as we all know, and that those echoes seem stronger there. And so for me, that just seemed a place that I could imagine. And I found connections with the Mississippi River, for example, that's everywhere in Minneapolis, St. Paul, which in Fitz's imagination connects to the blues music that he plays, to the city of St. Louis, where his father played. So it just seemed like a lot of things seem to work and make that a good choice for a setting.
It's very different from the Minnesota novels of mystery writer John Sanford. Is there more regional writing?
Well, I love writing in a particular place, and whether it's a sort of this thing that John Sanford does, or the way that Charles Baxter, say, writes about the Great Lakes region, whether in Michigan or in Minnesota, because we're always somewhere. And I took great delight in writing about Buffalo and the Girl Who Threw Butterflies and the way the sky looks and the way the houses are set. So I think it's important that fiction is connected to place because we are connected to place. A friend of mine pointed out that both my books have important scenes that take place on porches in older homes. And a newer home wouldn't have a porch. It would have a deck. It would have a garage that's connected to the house. And so the sort of sociability, the fact that they can play guitar sitting on the porch, is important. And I found a picture of the house that I imagine was Fitz's, an older home, very much like a Buffalo home. And so I think you need that level of specificity and concreteness and location to write fiction.
How different is it writing fiction when you're also a teacher? You don't go off to your writing room at 7 a.m. and write until you've written 200 perfect words or something like that. How complicated is it to be both?
It's probably not more complicated than having another job, so I do my writing early in the morning, and then I have to attend to classes and meetings and conferences and that sort of thing. I think it's a big plus that I get to be around people who love books and language and stories, and I'm lucky enough to have colleagues who are writers and to be with young people who take writing and novels seriously. So I'm always thinking about fiction. I'm thinking about character. I'm thinking about storytelling when I'm in my classes, and I think that's got to be a big plus. My head is in the same place.
How much cred does it give you with your students that not only are you a writer, you're a published writer?
Well, I think they notice. They want to achieve mastery, and they want to apprentice themselves to someone who knows what he's talking about. And that's not just my credibility. They know that Knopf publishes a handful of books that they think are excellent. And so that credibility, I think, is important. And obviously, that's something that they're aiming for and they're aspiring to. In the same way that I had a wonderful writing class from a professor, and he'd published his first book this semester. I think I was taking a class from him, and that was not lost on me, that this is someone who had achieved that level of credence by his peers.
Now, the publishing cycle of a book is such that you're probably writing another one.
I'm making some tentative beginnings. I'm a very slow writer, and it takes me a long time, so I don't have anything that is nearly complete, but I'm making a beginning.
Is this going to be an adult or a young adult book?
I've got a couple of things. I still like to write short stories. I've got a short story. I know that I've got a wonderful first sentence and that's demanding the rest of the story for adults, adult literary fiction, and I've got sort of some characters knocking around in my head that I think would be another book for young readers.
That's an interesting comment about the first sentence. A lot of writers say that the whole book is based on that first sentence.
I don't know about a whole book, but for me, first sentences are disproportionately important. First sentence of a book, first sentence of a chapter, and I think there's the seeds of the book are in there if you pay attention to it. There's a tone, there's an attitude, and I think that sometimes with writing, it's sort of unfolding from that sort of little embryonic beginning what that seed is going to grow into. So I think that's fairly common, that first sentences are important.
You go back to Virgil and the opening of the Aeneid, I will sing of arms and the man, arm of Arumque Cano, and it all spins from there.
And early sentences in this book were important. That first scene, I always knew it was going to begin there with him watching his dad's apartment and the notion where he thinks of himself as fairly ordinary and his guitar in his room and his song lyrics and the crush on the girl, but the gun in the waistband of his jeans and that gnawing hunger for his father. So that's sort of the whole book in miniature right there. And then where is this going to lead?
When did you decide, I'm going to be a writer?
I never would have said that out loud. I think that the thought crossed my mind when I was an undergraduate. And as a kid, I was always a reader, and I liked telling stories, and I loved language. But as an English major and being lucky enough to study with Lon Otto, who's both a professor and a writer, I thought, I would love to do this. And as I said, I would never have announced that because it would seem pretentious. But I had the quiet resolve to work and see where that would take me. So I think since being an undergraduate, that was something that I really wanted to do. And one of the few things that I'm good enough at to think that it could carry me somewhere.
Well, looking in the locked bottom drawer of your desk, how many unpublished manuscripts would there be?
No unpublished novels, that's for sure. And I was lucky enough, I didn't start writing novels till I was in my 30s. And so I tell myself I didn't write my unpublishable novels. I was always writing short stories. So I probably got some abandoned short stories, but for the most part, it's a big commitment to start a novel, and I've been lucky enough that the novels that I've spent a couple of years with have all been novels that have been published and have found readers.
What do you read?
I read everything. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read classics. I read contemporary fiction, and it's sort of all grist for the mill. And obviously, I read. I taught a course this last semester, writing for young readers. So I read novels. I chose novels by literary writers who have also written for young readers, and that was instructive. Writers like Julia Alvarez or Salman Rushdie. Joyce Carol Oates has a great young adult novel. So,
also a local native.
That's right. So to see how they do what they do, but to cast it in the genre of the young adult novel is instructive.
At least one of your fellow faculty members has a new book out. She's writing about the great Spanish influenza plague. Do other faculty members come to you and say, you know, I need a little help?
We talk about, Jane Fisher loves to talk about the Spanish influenza. And so we'll talk about what we're working on or what we're reading, but nobody has ever asked me for help with their scholarly manuscripts. I think they're sufficiently different. So we're more a community. And obviously, my colleague Eric Gansworth is an accomplished novelist. And we talk about books that we love. We talk about writers that we admire. Sometimes we'll talk a little bit about the business of publishing, but we're a little community of mutual support and respect.
But the problem is everybody knows, and you hear this all the time, that so many scholarly books are well-researched, the footnotes are wonderful, and the text is unreadable.
I confess I don't read as many scholarly articles as I used to for just that reason, and I think that's too bad. My academic work was on Samuel Johnson, and he was the greatest critic of his age, and he was a beautiful writer, and he wrote for ordinary people. And I think there still are writers like that. John Updike's criticism in New Yorker was brilliant and readable and clear. And so I think scholars have not done themselves a great service by retreating into this sort of self-contained universe where only 10 people in the world can understand what they've written.
This attitude that if people like it and want to read it, it's got to be bad?
That's right, and that's too bad. And so I'm a storyteller, and I think that stories are who we are, and that's how we understand the world, and it goes back to Homer and Virgil and the stories that we tell around the table. So in that sense, I'm the opposite of an elitist, that storytelling is for everyone. It's not just for people with PhDs.
I always had trouble with Virgil and Latin, but it's one of those things. Mick Cochran has been here today talking about his new book, Fitz, A Father, A Son, and A Gun. Mick, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mike.